When NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg came to the CAP Center in Concord, a good-sized crowd gathered to hear what she had to say. Of course, she had her thoughts about what the big cases are likely to be this term for the Supreme Court, but she's also enjoyed tremendous privilege in the form of her access to the justices and had some interesting things to say about them, too. Here and Now co-host Robin Young asked her about this and asked her to fact-check some of the statements made by presidential candidates recently.
I want to get your thoughts, Nina, on how the Constitution has been spoken of in the presidential race. I start with you have Ted Cruz, who says that he will amend it to end birthright citizenship. Now, Donald Trump is against birthright citizenship, the idea of someone is born here, even to parents who are not citizens, they have a birthright. But he says, you know, it would take way too long to change it. So let's just say that it doesn't mean people who were born to people who are children of undocumented immigrants. Let's just say that it doesn't mean them. As you're listening to the Constitution invoked this way, your thoughts?
Robin, that's not fair. I did a piece about the current term, which begins talking about the way that the various candidates talked about not just the Supreme Court, but John Roberts, the Chief Justice, in particular. And, you know, John Roberts has a very conservative record. He was a dissenter in the same-sex marriage cases. He has voted against any racial preferences, against affirmative action. He wrote the opinion striking down the key provision of the Voting Rights Act. He has consistently voted to strike down regulations governing campaign finance campaign spending, and all of which has opened the floodgates to enormous amounts of cash in our election systems, not just at the federal level, but at the state level as well. And there's only one subject on which he has cast a vote that conservatives don't like, and that's Obamacare. And so that's his cardinal sin. But the way that everybody was talking about him during that second debate, you would have thought he was a liberal like William O. Douglas. I mean, it was sort of bizarre for anybody who knows anything about the court. This man is a very conservative justice. And even Jeb Bush said that he would fight for his nominees and that fighting was sort of the essential part of this, and that what was wrong with John Roberts essentially was that he was confirmable by the Senate. I mean, it's just sort of, I went back and I looked at the transcript and I sort of scratched my head. You want to be really not just fair, but also appropriate when you talk about something like that. And you have a hard time. So I wrote a line that I changed. So there, I used a cut, I think, of Ted Cruz saying, if John Roberts were not Chief Justice, something like this, we would have gotten rid of Obamacare, and same-sex marriage would not be legal across the country. And my original line was, never mind that Chief Justice Roberts wrote the lead dissent in the same-sex marriage case. But I decided that that was too snippy, so I changed it to something like, of course, John Roberts wrote the dissent.
Well, but look at the other, I mean, there, much was made of Republicans when those cases came out, saying, well, it's just the Supreme Court. I mean, why is the Supreme Court getting to judge things like health care, and, you know, it's just...
Because somebody has to, is
the
answer.
Yeah, disconnect there.
Somebody has to. That's the way the Constitution is written.
Right. But Hillary Clinton has come out and said that she wants to explore the...
She said she would have a litmus test.
Well, but she also said that she wants to push for an amendment to, in effect, overturn the 2010 Citizens United decision. But isn't that the same? You know, isn't that someone saying the court was wrong?
Of course, there's nothing in. Lots of times people say the court was wrong, and if you're lucky, it's not a constitutional ruling, it's a statutory ruling, and you can get Congress to go back and change the law. And that happens on both the liberal and the conservative side, and not that infrequently, or at least used to happen not that infrequently, but these days Congress doesn't do much of anything, so, you know. If the decision is based on the Constitution, then the only way to change it is by a constitutional amendment. And there's nothing wrong with trying to have a constitutional amendment, except that all those of you folks who clapped when they said, you know, that she favored a constitutional amendment, I defy you to sit down and try to write something about the First Amendment that would change it in a way that would not open a door to something you would really hate a lot.
But remind us, so what would the language have to be?
Well, so let's give you an example. If you wrote a constitutional amendment that said only, money is not speech for purposes of the First Amendment. Okay, that sounds pretty good. Now let's say you're in the middle of, let's pick an unpopular war like the Vietnam War, and you want to run an ad. In the newspaper, you want to buy or you want to run an ad on TV, let's say, or on the radio, that opposes the war. And the local radio or TV station won't sell you the time. And you've met all the other qualifications, and they're discriminating against you based only on the fact that you oppose the war, and you want to spend money on their network or on their station to oppose the war. Well, you're in a bit of a pickle.
You're not protected. Talk about the dinner parties at your home. You have, you've had the justices over for dinner?
Not as a group.
Not as a group. Because would they not?
Never.
Is that one of those where you could not seat so-and-so next to so-and-so?
No, they're not that big. We're talking about six or eight people for dinner. We're not talking about some grand, you know, thing with... We make dinner. People serve themselves and sit down and have dinner.
Are there off-the-record conversations?
Oh, they're all off-the-record. I mean, you don't have people for dinner and have it be an on-the-record conversation, God knows. But I would never ask a justice about a case that was in front of them or anything like that. And that's sort of the quid pro quo is, and a lot of these people that sit on the court, I have known for a very long time, and way before they were on the court. They're not going to be my friends now that they are on the court? That's ridiculous.
Does Clarence Thomas, does he speak, is he loquacious at all? I mean, when he's outside of the courtroom.
Well, I don't see a great deal of him because he doesn't, and he lives quite far outside Washington, and he doesn't do a lot of the things that one might see somebody in, you know, he doesn't go to sort of a big legal reception at the court. You're not likely to see him there. I see him at the Supreme Court musical concerts, that he does come to those, but then he leaves, so you don't actually, you know, talk to him there. And, you know, I don't see him at other musical events or theater events in Washington. So he did ask questions early on in his tenure on the court, and I think it's 7, maybe 8 years that he hasn't asked a question. And I think that this is now, you know, for him, a decision he made. And he's right about the fact that often counsel does not get to really make their argument because they're getting so pummeled with questions. And he said, you know, as somebody who argued before courts as an appellate advocate when he worked in the state AG's office, that he liked being able to make his argument and not be interrupted every 2 seconds. Well, that's not the way it is in the Supreme Court. It's typical that justices will ask, you know, over the course of an hour-long argument, 70 or more questions. And It's a very hot bench these days, and that's just the way it is.
Hot bench.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning?
It wasn't a hot bench when I first started covering the court. It was much quieter. But I think that this is their only chance to sort of not only hear what the advocates have to say, but get a sense of what the concerns are of other members of the court. And other than this is not like Congress, where they have committee hearings and there's a lot of personal lobbying. That doesn't go on a lot. I mean, sometimes members of the court, two or three of them, will meet to discuss a particular opinion they're working on, maybe jointly, or that they have they're trying to work out some sort of a compromise they can all live with. But for the most part, it's a pretty solitary job. And they work in 9 separate legal chambers, and they write individually and circulate the material to each other, and then get back a lot of feedback, and then there's a back and forth that's largely in writing. So that the only time they sit down together is at the conference, the weekly conference after the oral arguments, when they speak in order of seniority, and nobody gets to speak a second time until everybody's spoken. So that's sort of limiting. So the oral argument is a very, I think, important to some members of the court, but And Scalia says that the worst experience he ever had as an advocate was standing up when he didn't get asked a lot of questions. So different strokes for different folks, and obviously Thomas has made a decision that he doesn't want to ask questions anymore.
When are we going to get to hear what goes on in the court? Do you think there...
You can hear right now.
No, but I mean in our lifetime there will be cameras in the court. There's no cameras in the court.
No, and I don't expect to see that in my lifetime either. I don't expect it to see it in your lifetime either. You know that your own Justice Souter famously said at some congressional hearing, having had the experience of having a Supreme Court that is televised here, as I understand it, that it, when they rolled in the cameras, they'd be roll into the Supreme Court, they'd be rolling them in over his dead body. And, you know, I think there is an argument to be made for that point of view. Among others, the one that you don't hear but I think is a very serious matter is that the Supreme Court is a pretty cloistered institution. And if you want to see it totally cloistered, you put them on TV and they will need round-the-clock protection. They will not be in the supermarket feeling the melons by themselves. They will be universally recognized. And you know they get a lot of protection now when they go to a public event. Something at the Kennedy Center or something like that. You'll see the little guys with things in their ears around. But they drive themselves. They live a regular life. They take their children to school. They, you know, they have the normal... I once was getting my nails done, and I walked out, and I see the Chief Justice of the United States down the hall. Nobody has recognized him. He's looking, there's a little ballet school for children down the hall, and he's watching his children in ballet school through a window, a little window. And it's such a wonderful insight into him. I mean, this is some years ago. They're young teenagers now, but they were kids. And apparently his son insisted that he do everything that his sister was doing. So he wanted to go to this dance school, and there was a separate little class for boys. And so Roberts is watching the 5 or 6 little boys doing stuff with a teacher. And he's standing there, and he's watching them, and turns to me, and he says, "I don't understand it. He does everything she tells him and nothing I tell him."
We are privileged to have that seat. You know, you have that seat on that world as it unfolds. Let's ask some questions about the court. Is it difficult for you to remain unbiased when interviewing someone with whom you disagree?
No. I have to say that the best First of all, I really do try to keep a little bit of a distance and not be hugely invested in the outcome of most cases. And you can do that most of the time, because when you read the briefs, you actually do see that there are good arguments on both sides. It's very rare that a case comes up where I can't at least see the argument on the other side. Even if I wouldn't like it to come out that way, I understand what the argument is, and it's a perfectly legitimate legal argument.
Well, it's the Supreme Court, so it's already made it through these lower courts. And
right.
Yeah.
So, and the second thing is, if you want to have a good piece, you better damn well get good interviews on both sides. And the last thing you want is a weak sister on one side, because then the piece is no good. Then I end up having to say, to sort of say the punchy good stuff. I don't want to have to do that. I want both the advocates on each side to be as good as they can be. And if I can't get somebody to do that, I am constantly fishing for somebody better to do it.
Well, stay with that for a second. This is NPR, and as you're well aware, after Juan Williams left because it was felt that he had expressed his opinions on the television show he was a part of, you know that a lot of the articles after that were asking about you, because you also have had a long history appearing on Washington Roundtable, those wonderful TV shows. And people felt that on occasion you had expressed your personal opinion, that Michelle Obama made people feel warm and fuzzy, that I can't even remember what some
of
the criticism
was. Well, I did express my personal opinion sometimes, but at no time that I can think of, this is the great irony of these things, did I express my personal opinion about anything I covered. So you might have been able to figure it out on occasion when I wasn't particularly artful, but my object always was not to do that. And the things that I felt perfectly free to express my opinion about were the things I probably knew the least about. So if you ask me what I thought about, you know, what should we do in Libya, I probably had an opinion. I read up on it and called a few experts, but, you know, you could destroy me in a minute, probably, because this is not my field of expertise. This is the media world we live in, that it is good for us to be on television, and as well as radio. It gets you recognized, and so people return your phone calls. And you want to have your phone calls returned.
We'll return to NPR's legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg in just a moment. A story you won't want to miss about the remarkable recovery of her father's violin, the Ames Totenberg Stradivarius. You're listening to the best of public radio from NHPR.